and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Search for Captain Slocum by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on chapter 15, and this is the 12th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast, or you can check out The Mariner Podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week, or of course, The Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. Chapter 15. The sloop was again doing her work, leaping along among the white horses. Far on his homeward way, the Boston Globe trumpeted. It was true. The captain's third Christmas out was spent on rough waters at the pitch of the Cape of Good Hope. While he was at the end of the bowsprit reefing the jib, the sloop, for a present, ducked him under three times. A passing English steamer, storm-tossed like the spray, ran up the signal, wishing you a Merry Christmas. A few days later, Slocum was able to beat his way into port and anchor in the bay off Cape Town. The voyage, he felt, was as good as done. The harbour master promptly sent out a steam launch to tow the spray to a more convenient berth, but the captain was not yet ready for that. He had weathered all alone the two great capes of the world, and now he wanted a day by himself, away from the bustle of the docks, just to think the whole thing over. But the next day, without fuss or hurry, he went ashore, this time to stay for 3 months. Leaving the spray and dry dock, he travelled far and wide, through the South African colonies on a railroad pass furnished by the government. He went on personal business to Kimberley, Johannesburg, and the goldfields of Witwatersrand. As he rode across the plains of Africa, he was seized by longing for a foothold on land. At Pretoria, he shook hands with President Kruger, one of the party mentioned that the guest was on his way around the world. Kruger, who believed the world was flat, corrected him. "You don't mean round the world, you mean in the world," the old statesman said, and glowered at Slocum. Everyone was embarrassed, except the president and the circumnavigator. The last was delighted with the nugget of information quarried out of Oompol. It sounds odd to hear scholars and statesmen say the world is flat, but it is a fact that three Boers of considerable learned ability prepared a work to support that contention, Slocum wrote only in the serialised version of Sailing Alone. While I was at Durban, they came from Pretoria to obtain data from me, and they seemed annoyed when I told them that they could not prove it by my experience. The next morning, I met one of the party. I bowed and made curves with my hands. He responded with a level, swimming movement of his hands. Returning to Cape Town, Slocum found the sloop waiting. Everything was in order. "The spray seldom fell among thieves," he wrote. "At the Keeling Islands, at Rodriguez, and at many places, a wisp of coconut fibre in the door latch, to indicate that the owner was away, secured the goods against even a longing glance. But when I came nearer home, stout locks were needed." On the 26th of March, 1898, he sailed from South Africa. 16 days later, early in the morning, the quack of a booby awoke him. It was as much as to say, "Skipper, there's land in sight." And there was. St. Helena, a speck in the South Atlantic. The captain reached for his bottle of port and drank the health of this invisible helmsman, the pilot of the Pinter. Slocum stayed 10 days, following a pattern which by now had become almost routine: sightseeing, lecturing, dinners with the governor, and then the farewell gifts of fruits and cakes. But at this departure, he received as well a rather singular offering, a goat. The animal would be companionable as a dog, he was told. Except for the first day out, before the beast got his sea legs, Slocum was not happy with his sailing companion. The goat threatened to devour everything from flying jib to stern davits. He was the worst pirate encountered on the voyage. One day, while the captain was on deck, the critter, in the cabin, ate the West Indies charts. "Alas," Slocum wrote, "there was not a rope in the sloop proof against the goat's awful teeth." At the next port of call, Ascension Island, further west and further north, the passenger was discharged at once. Slocum made it 27th of April. In spite of having shoved off alone, he had had a succession of fellow travellers: a Boston spider, a tree crab, a rat, a centipede, a pair of crickets, but he had had no luck with any of them. Slocum continued on his way alone, passing by Fernando de Noronha off the coast of Brazil 8th of May. The spray crossed the track homeward bound that she had made on the voyage out. Though the captain was still in the South Atlantic, some 4,000 miles from home, he had now encircled the world. Sailing along the coast of Brazil, the captain was in old familiar waters. He had had but to follow where the Liberdade 10 years before had sailed, or where the Aquidneck earlier had left her tracks. He had put a whole world between himself and those days, but only to come full circle. Strange and long-forgotten current ripples patter against the sloop's sides in grateful music. I sat quietly listening, while the spray kept on her course. On the 14th of May, Slocum was in the Brazil current, making almost 200 miles a day, and already north of the equator, when he saw a mast, with the stars and stripes floating from it, he wrote, rising astern as if poked up out of the sea, and then rapidly appearing on the horizon, like a citadel, the Oregon. The Spanish-American War had begun almost a month before, and on the 25th of April, President McKinley had admitted that a state of war existed. Though Slocum had heard rumours of war, he did not know war had actually come. Neither shooting nor shouting had been heard as yet in the South Atlantic Islands. The battleship Oregon, Captain Charles E. Clark, on the Pacific coast when hostilities began, had been ordered to join the Atlantic fleet by moving from ocean to ocean through the Strait of Magellan. When Slocum saw her coming on astern of his vessel, she was making a record-breaking run for Key West. Later, she went to Santiago and then took part in the naval battle. Laid down in 1891, the Oregon had a speed of 16 knots. Her displacement was 10,288 tons, little enough for a battleship, but still she was 1,000 times the size of the Spray. As the battleship steamed nearer, Slocum saw her signals, but could not at first make them out because he had no binoculars. However, when she passed ahead, he read her flags, Charlie Bravo Tango, meaning, "Are there any men of war about?" "No," Slocum signalled in reply, and added he had not been looking for any. The final signal, Captain Slocum to Captain Clark, "Let us keep together for mutual protection." But this, in Slocum's words, the commander of the Oregon did not seem to regard as necessary. Clark was prepared to encounter the Spanish fleet, which he thought was on its way to intercept him. Instead, he met up with the Spray. When night came, Slocum sat alone again, thinking how the Spray, having cleared all dangers of the voyage, might, at the 11th hour, become a victim of war. But finally, a strong hope mastered my fears. From the Spray's logbook, 18th of May, 1898. "Tonight, in latitude 7 degrees 13 minutes north, for the first time in nearly 3 years, I see the North Star." Now the captain steered for the British West Indies, but sorely missed the charts the St. Helena goat had eaten. Finding himself among mysterious breakers, he had to rely on memory and knowledge of the sea and love of her who had brought him this far. "But you'll go by, Spray, old girl," he shouted in the night. And she made it, and he slapped her on the transom, proud of her last noble effort. Slocum reached Grenada on the 42nd day out from Cape Town. A lion now, he promptly was waylaid by a reporter. The conversation, however, was brief, for the captain was on his way to a meal on shore, and was not altogether in the mood to be pestered by an interviewer. The interviewer wrote, "Slocum lectured at Grenada. The hall was filled. He did the same at Antigua, further north among the islands. On the 5th of June, he left the West Indies to sail for a United States port. It was the last leg of the voyage. The Spray was booming along joyously for home now, making good time, when suddenly she struck the horse latitudes. There was not a breath of wind. For 8 days the captain was becalmed. The sea was so smooth that evening after evening he could read on deck by the light of a candle. Under such circumstances, a less self-sufficient man might have been swallowed up in the solitude of waiting. But the captain knew a philosophical turn of thought now was not amiss, else one's patience would have given out almost at the harbour entrance. The final calm of the voyage preceded one of the final storms. On the 20th of June, a gale was blowing, accompanied by cross seas that tumbled about and shook things up with great confusion. The Spray's rigging gave way, the jib stay broke at the masthead, and jib and all fell into the water, but Slocum managed somehow to rescue his gear. Then, with no one at the wheel to steady the vessel, the master of nautical legerdemain claimed the swaying mast and made the repairs. But he was tired, tired, tired of baffling squalls and fretful cobble seas. He had not seen a ship for days. As to the whistling of the wind through the rigging, he wrote, and the slopping of the sea against the sloop's sides, well, that was well enough in its way, and we could not have gone on without it, the spray and I, but there was so much of it now. On the 25th of June, Slocum was working along towards Fire Island, when a tornado struck which, an hour before, had swept New York City. He had seen it coming and was ready for it. The climax storm of the voyage, he called it. Up to that point, he had been bound for New York, but when the storm was over, he hove the ship onto another tack. Under short sail, he reached in for the Long Island coast, while Slocum sat thinking and watching the lights of coasting vessels. At that moment, a cabin boy on board a sloop about 2 miles to windward and caught in the same storm saw the yawl-rigged spray. Many years later, he wrote, "We saw her start sheets and head in an easterly direction. Of course, we did not recognize the spray at that time, but later we realized that the little yawl we saw must have been the spray, for the fact that she carried not the customary gaff-headed sail, but a balanced or standing lug on the jigger. This sail was so rare in the United States, in fact, is so now, that the vessels carrying it can be numbered on the fingers of one hand." Slocum steered for Newport. The weather was fine, and only one danger was left. Newport Harbour was mined. But the spray, hugging the rocks so as to avoid friend and foe, slipped in. At 1 a.m., 27th of June, 1898, she was safe inside, and the captain dropped anchor to end a voyage of more than 46,000 miles. He had been away 3 years, 2 months, and 2 days. Still, according to Slocum, the spray was not quite satisfied till I sailed her around to her birthplace. And neither was he, but for different reasons. Now my wish is to come back to New Bedford and Fairhaven and to sail through the old bridge, he wrote the New Bedford Standard. Is the old gateman there, still at the gate? On the 3rd of July, with a fair wind, the spray, he wrote, waltzed beautifully round the coast and up the Acushnet River to Fairhaven, where I secured her to the cedar spile driven in the bank to hold her when she was launched. I could bring her no nearer home. Chapter 16. Thus the voyage was a natural outcome not only of my love of adventure, but of my lifelong experience. So long as Slocum kept sailing, he found momentary solutions to the conflict in his nature. The unusual type of living enabled him to isolate and remove himself, and also to exhibit himself as humorously or boastfully as he needed to. It permitted him to express his gentleness and humble devotion, and also his violence and sensuousness. After Virginia's death, he seems to have been unable to find a woman who could really accept his tenderness and warmer feelings. Instead, he lavished them on the spray. By determination and stubbornness and love, he took possession of the boat, while the boat was taking possession of him. What they subsequently went through together helped satisfy the craving for fusion. And then there was the sea. The sea which, from the beginning, had fascinated him. For the brine-burnt seafarer aging now, the earth was tolerable still because of its oceans. Cradled on the rocking waters, he found the harmony and serenity he strove for. In his way, he accomplished the desire to re-enter and be born again. But practically speaking, what problems had he resolved? The trip was over, and the ex-merchantman was some 15 years past the high point of his career. Despite his courage and faithfulness to calling, the pull of the downhill run was relentless. There was no way to stop it. The voyage was done, and Slocum had returned to the ways of houses and families, common sense customs and newspaper values. Early yesterday morning, said the Newport Herald, a staunch-looking little craft swung lazily into the harbour and cast anchor off Commercial Wharf. She was a stranger in these waters, and her rig attracted the attention of the early risers. The solitary occupant of the boat busied himself in making everything neat and tidy aboard ship, and appeared to be totally oblivious of the curiosity he was arousing. When the master of the craft had prepared everything to his satisfaction, he jumped into a dory and sculled ashore. Nothing but the uncomprehending stare of idlers on the waterfront greeted the spray and her captain. Stepping onto his native land, Slocum had to make himself known. His achievement had been completely blanketed by the Spanish-American War. The papers were too busy whipping it up to give much notice to a displaced merchant captain. He could not make the front page, not even in Newport. The Boston Globe put him on the last. New York papers gave him scant coverage, the Times none at all. It is true that Slocum had not changed the course of history, but in his way he had made a bit of it. And he knew it too. He had expected and was ready for a friendly demonstration. His nature was such that he needed it, but he did not get it. His reception at home was quite different from those he had enjoyed in foreign and especially in British ports. Americans were wary of this tall tale. They knew the tradition of elaborate jokes and newspaper hoaxes. They had heard of travels in balloons and expeditions to the moon. The solo circumnavigation was a fake, they said. But Slocum produced the Spray's yacht license, stamped in every port she had visited. After that, former confrères in the merchant service hinted that the ex-merchantman coming from South Africa was a diamond smuggler. But some others were inclined to believe in the captain. Word got around, and within 24 hours there was a modest but spontaneous show of interest. The Spray and her gallant skipper were visited by hundreds. No one hurried to Newport faster than Mabel Wagnalls. The first name on the Spray's visitor's book in the home port was written by the one who always said, "The Spray will come back." So the captain wrote at the end of the narrative of the voyage. He had carried Mabel's musical story around the world. Now he handed it back to her with an inscription, "A thousand thanks. Good wishes are prayers heard by the angels." And so June 28, 1898, the little book, after making the circuit of the earth, returns. What ups and downs, Miserere, you have had in your round. You have been twice through the Straits of Magellan, once off Cape Horn. You have seen Juan Fernandez, St. Helena, and many more islands in the sea. The Cape of Good Hope, you weathered unharmed. Again, you have lain quietly in your snug box, while the skipper whistled for wind or spent a night on deck in the storm. For weeks and weeks, again, little book, no human voice has stirred the air to vibrate a chord among your leaves, and the only music you heard was the tune of the waves. You saw the lonely atoll in the midst of the sea, where the waves, lashing and with eternal roar, spent their fury on its trembling rim. You have been read and reread by the captain. Henceforth, little book, you will be in smooth seas, while benefited old friend may still sail on. Farewell. J.S. Though the words were addressed to a mildly gothic romance, they composed themselves into a love letter to its author. This may or may not have been the captain's intention. There is no way of knowing precisely what they were to one another, the sea-worn, literary sailor and the sheltered, piano-playing lady. One can only say that it could have been. They were gifted, imaginative and word-minded people. Their relationship was based on a mutual need, the need for communication. The Boston Globe said that, upon arrival, the captain wired Hetty at once, but she did not or could not get to Newport till the evening of the 28th. The Newport Herald reported, as she had three times mourned her husband as dead, their reunion was touching. Perhaps Slocum never would have done what he did if Virginia had lived, and perhaps he would not have done it if Hetty had been a different sort of woman. But when she refused to sail with him, then there was nothing he needed her for. He did not need her for cooking, sewing, care of children, nursing, literary advice, or sex. The companionship he required, she clearly was unable to provide. In a way, he, like many others, had made history out of being unhappy at home. And now it seemed that, after having come around the world, the hero was, in every way, back at the starting point, except for one thing. Before he left Newport, he got a telegraphed offer from the Century Company. It came from Richard Watson Gilder, poet and editor of the Century Illustrated monthly magazine and brother of Joe Gilder, the captain's friend. The latter had, of course, been following the progress of the voyage, and so had Clarence Clough Boole, an assistant editor of the Century and a yachting enthusiast. Slocum replied by telegram, and the next day, the 30th of June, he followed it up with a long letter on his special Round the World letterhead. He said he had not written for magazines before, but had very decided literary tastes. "I have made a voyage such as even the Emperor of Germany could not do and first building his own ship. It has been to me like reading a book, and more interesting as I turned the pages over. I know what all means, and I know what men have said about it. The story will keep. No one short of bone and muscle and pine knots will lower the record. The most interesting and instructive part is never touched by the daily reporters. I am misquoted by them till I am discouraged, for the public stomach will sicken. If you were on the spray, I could show you, sir, what interest has been taken in her voyage in foreign countries, and especially by our British friends. Without saying Slocum, Slocum all the time, that I do not care for, I know that the whole story will be hard to beat. My ship, essentially mine, is as tight today as the best ship afloat. Her pump is dry enough for matchwood, not wormed, not worn. My ship is as good or better than she was the day I launched her, and I myself, I am 10 years younger than I was the day I fell the first tree for the construction of my bark. This letter crossed one from the editor to the captain, in which the former asked how much of the story of the voyage had been written for newspaper publication, and what there was to the rumour of diamonds coming in on the spray. To the first question, the answer was almost none. To the second, I thought of bringing one diamond from Kimberley, just to flash at the Goddess of Liberty as we sail up your harbour, the spray and I, but I do not do even that. Had I brought it, I would have told the customs of it. I brought away their gold instead. To this I know there is no objection on any hand. From Johannesburg also I brought gold enough to pay the old debts I made when I owned and sailed the bigger ship. My vessel was in a cargo, to be sure, but clean, open, and above board. I tried to make myself believe that I was sailing for the dollars I should make in trading. In this way, I do make a dollar perhaps as much as captains make ordinarily, but the love of adventure has been, after all, a potent factor to carry me beyond. This latter may not appeal to the hearts of my countrymen so much as the dollars and cents. I claim only to be one of the poorest of American sailors, and having nothing else to do, made a voyage. Almost from the minute the voyage was over, the captain felt desperately idle, and even while he yearned for a homecoming, he was dreaming of further conquests. His instinct to do and to take command was exacerbated by the war. He seethed with pent-up patriotism. Devotion to the sea mingled with intense desire to make his abilities count. "I burn to be of some use now, of all times," he announced in a public letter to his friends and creditors in New Bedford. "I spent the best of my life in the Philippine Islands, China, and Japan. I am not fanatically suffering for a fight, but I am longing to be useful. Does Mr. McKinley want pilots for the Philippines and Guam?" Soon after he arrived in New Bedford and anchored in the Acushnet River off Poverty Point, 3rd July, his oldest and youngest sons came down from Boston. Victor was 26, Garfield 15, Slocum was 54. Vic was the parent's greeting to his former first mate. "You could have done it, but you would not be the first." Local reporters went aboard. Though some were appreciative, one described the trip as the most remarkable voyage ever attempted by any navigator. Slocum, after tossing them his scrapbooks filled with clippings from foreign papers, seemed more interested in talking of what he would do rather than what he had done. The prize was won, and now life put its lesser claims again. "I am prepared to pay all my bills with the legal rate of interest," he said. Then, speaking of the voyage, he said that it isn't finished yet by any means. "I intend to go to London before long." He rested in New Bedford no longer than he had in many other ports, and he lectured, for this was now his main source of income. When he had recruited himself and refitted the spray, he sailed again, not for London, for no offers had come from that direction, but for New York. He went looking for business. He was frantic to be doing something. Hetty went with him. They found rooms in the city, on a cross-town street on the Lower West Side, Garfield recalled. On the 5th of August, the New York Times noted the captain's arrival. There was the offer from the Century, but writing was not the captain's first choice. First of all, he was a navigator and a commander. The idea of a college ship, mentioned more than a year before in the letter written Joe Gilder from Keeling Cocos, was still in the front of his mind. Such a ship would meet his requirements. It would be useful. It would have dignity and prestige. It might bring a livelihood. In any case, it would provide a platform and a command. People would have to sit up and take notice. He explained the scheme before a few friends, foregathered in a room in Carnegie Hall on the evening of the 30th of October. he proposed the building of a vessel patterned on a fine clipper ship with some improvements. She was to accommodate 300 student passengers for a 2-year cruise of the world. The time was to be spent in study, work, and recreation. The object was to train young men as navigators, capable of handling and directing sailing and steamships, including men of war. He himself would teach nautical astronomy, the subject he had taught himself so well. Others would give instruction in seamanship and engineering, and also in some of the liberal arts. Slocum may have got the germ of the idea from the U.S. Coast Guard's floating academy, the bark Solomon P. Chase, which for many years was based at New Bedford. She had been built as a school ship and was in commission till 1907, but the captain's concept of a college ship went beyond the usual school ship education. There were to be advantages and attractions besides the strictly nautical ones. The student passenger might, if he preferred, take the courses offered in literature and other of the higher branches. Also, the cruise was not to be for men only. The captain had not changed his views since the days when he wanted Virginia on board. In fact, he said he would have no part in his own project if women could not be included in its benefits. Nothing came of this plan. Thereupon, Slocum decided to charter instead of build a vessel. Wherever he lectured, he talked about the college ship, in Cambridge, Gloucester, and even in Concord, New Hampshire. Father tried to get a college professor and people enough to pay for a voyage, but he could not get them. He was very disappointed, Garfield wrote. Author's note: yet from both educational and practical points of view, Slocum seems to have been reasonably right. To this day, quite a number of school ships are sailing, giving sail training to young men who would follow the sea. Very few, however, sail under American or British flags. In 1955, Captain Irving M. Johnson and his wife of the brigantine Yankee completed their 6th round-the-world voyage with a paying crew of college-age men and women. Slocum was a friend of Captain Johnson's father, Clifton Johnson. As a very young boy, Irving had seen Slocum in the Johnson home, but it was the reading of his book, Captain Johnson told the present writer, that gave me an urge to do something similar. And so the high hopes failed. Slocum still could not get a command. He was still at rock bottom, only older now, and more of his energies expended. Well, as he had done once before at the end of a small boat voyage, he would tell his story. He had not made any money writing, but he would try again. Perhaps what he wrote, Richard Gilder, would, after all, come to pass. When my countrymen have time to think it over, they will not be shamed of the spray. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.